on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Abigail Carter was in her mid-30s, and she seemed to have it all. A career, a great husband, and two equally great kids. But on the 11th of September 2001, her life was altered when her husband was killed at the World Trade Center. The Alchemy of Loss, A Young Widow's Transformation, is her first book, and it is a deeply personal memoir of her experiences dealing with grief and filling the voids her husband Aaron Dack's death brought about. Catherine Ashenberg, who's been on the program before, writes on the back that the book is an eloquent, brave, and even occasionally comic account, and that through it all she is a generous, nuanced, and admirably honest guide. The Alchemy of Loss is published by McClelland & Stewart and retails for $32.99. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program Abigail Carter. Good morning, Ms. Carter.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. I must admit that I feel almost intrusive asking you about the book and what happened, especially after reading the book. It's sort of an anxiety, I suppose.
Well, you need not have it.
Is my reaction, though, is that something that you've encountered since September 11th and now on this book tour?
Actually, no. You know, I think once people start hearing me, and I guess I'm very straightforward with, you know, pretty much anything that people throw at me in terms of questions. And it's sort of what I'm hoping actually to break down a little bit with my book in sort of, I don't know what the word is, demystifying the 9/11 widow. you know, I'm really kind of, I really am striving to make the loss accessible, if it's at all possible. Because I think what I encountered in loss would really help other people who are also going through loss. And by loss, I mean, you know, it can be anything from the loss of a spouse, the way I experienced, or, you know, it could be a divorce, it could be even loss of a pet. You know, there's a whole bunch of loss, levels of loss that, that are very universal and that people go through, and, you know, everybody is going to encounter loss at some point in their lives. So I'm really hoping to, as I say, kind of break down the, you know, the fear, I guess, of loss and of death and of being able to talk about it frankly.
In writing this book, you obviously have come to some new understanding of what happened, also how to manage one's emotions. How do you get to that point, and when was it for you that you got to that point that you were able to perhaps discuss this and sort of look at it almost objectively?
Well, I think, you know, the process of writing a book forces you to, you know, re-examine very carefully and read over and over and over again and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, you're having to kind of relive it every time you read it over again or every time it gets edited. So it does sort of break it down and make it, you know, kind of winds up being a little bit more abstract in my mind as opposed to emotional. So it's sort of like, in the process of writing the book, I was able to kind of stand back from the emotion of it a bit, you know, which is what kind of gave me the perspective that I needed in order to really reflect on some of my experiences. And, you know, which isn't to say I don't still grieve, you know, like, but they're sort of two separate things for me at this point, because the book is sort of, it's kind of an encapsulated piece of what I've gone through. I think that best describes it. Yeah.
Well, would it be trite to say that it gets easier as time goes by, that well-worn phrase, time healing everything, does that apply, do you think?
It does to a certain degree, but I think it's very easy to kind of, you know, to use that as sort of a pat answer to all, and it actually isn't. You know, grief just isn't that linear, and, you know, you can be 30 years on, and I think still, you know, have these incredible pangs of grief, you know, that are reminiscent to, you know, brand new grief. It's one of those things that comes back again and again and again. It's always there, and you're always going through these stages. You know, I talk in the book about the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, and, you know, the numbness, the denial, the anger, you know, all these stages happen for sure, but I think the misconception with her stages is that they actually happen linearly, and that, you know, one stage happens right after the next, happens after the next, and happens after the next, with this idea that, you know, you somehow come out the other end like a tunnel, and you're done. And it's just so not, it's just so not how it happens, you know. Sort of like, you know, you go through the denial one minute, and then you're going through anger, and then the denial comes back, and then the, you know, it's just a sort of like an ongoing kind of cycle of stuff that, you know, and you get through a bit of it, and then, you know, you have a new level. You've reached a new level, but then there's another level that you have to reach, and you're just constantly sort of navigating this, I don't know what to call it, a beast, almost. You know, you're constantly sort of on these different paths that you don't expect. There's all sorts of, you know, sort of triggers out there. You know, a song comes onto the radio, or a smell, or, you know, sort of wandering around. I was wandering around Toronto last week, sort of reminiscing about, you know, oh, I remember that restaurant Aaron and I did this and that at, you know, that kind of thing. It just, stuff comes at you constantly.
How did you and Aaron meet?
We met at a party in Toronto that I went to with a mutual friend of, as it turned out, a mutual friend of ours. And, yeah, it was just kind of, it was just a party. It was very random.
You're both Canadian?
Yeah, well, we both grew up there. But I was born in the U.S. and then grew up in Canada. And so that was what enabled us to stay, to live in the States, to work there. And then he was born in England and grew up in Canada. And so we were able to live and work in London as well. So we, my kids now have 3 passports each. It's kind of crazy.
How long had you been living in New Jersey?
We, before he died, we'd been there about 4 years.
And how are Olivia and Carter today? Yeah, those are your children. Olivia's the daughter.
Yeah.
Carter's the son.
Uh-huh. They're well, you know, I mean, we still have bouts as they reach new levels of understanding. You know, obviously Carter was very young when it happened. Well, they both were. Carter was 2 and Olivia was 6. And so, you know, as they grow and understand more about the world, and, you know, they have new questions and different questions, and, you know, they go through grief in somewhat odd ways, you know, to the point that sometimes with kids it's really hard to tell that they're grieving. You know, it'll come out in sort of, you know, like temper tantrums over homework, or it'll come out just, you know, in sort of very strange kind of fears and phobias that they might have. It's a continuing dialogue that I have with them. And, you know, as I say, as they grow and become more cognizant of things, you know, the questions become more sophisticated, I guess.
There's a comical moment in the book where, I guess, the Canadian parliamentarians had gone down to ground zero, I suppose, to meet with families such as yours,
mm-hmm.
and Carter slapped Joe Clark.
Slapped him right across the face. Yes, thank you, Krispy Kreme donut.
It had quite a bit, I guess, as you were preparing to go to this meeting, right?
Yes, yes. Well, they had, you know, it was like they had a little kids' table full of, like, candies and treats, and oh, my goodness. So, yeah, very high on sugar.
In this path through grief, is it different for everyone?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think I liken it to fingerprints, you know. Everybody's going to have a completely different experience. But, you know, I really did try to tap into some of the universal experiences. You know, I talk about buying a new bed, which is, you know, I know from talking to a bunch of other widows that the bed is it's very, it's very kind of volatile, you know. It's become sort of this big, huge symbol. And a lot of people, after a loss of a spouse, just, you know, the marital bed becomes really difficult thing to deal with, and a lot of people buy new beds, and that was my experience, and that's what I write about, you know. So
in terms of regret, how do you deal with that? I mean, you ideas must go through your head very soon after, years after even, of what one should have done, what one did. How
yeah.
do you deal with that?
Definitely, I think in the earlier days, I had tons of regrets. You know, it was all the things that Aaron was going to miss having to do with the kids. It was, you know, the fact that we didn't take a weekend alone, that, you know, we'd been really wanting to take. It was, you know, sort of his regrets as well. I mean, he had set goals for himself for you know, he wanted to have certain things done by the time he reached 40. And of course, when he died, he was about 3 months away from his 40th birthday. And he hadn't met those goals, you know, and so I had regrets around that. I had regrets. I'd been to the funeral of one of his good friends who died just before 9/11. And he died very young of a heart attack. And Aaron hadn't gone to the funeral. And I was very angry at him because, you know, he had missed the funeral as a result of an important business meeting. And, you know, the funeral wound up being all about this lovely man who, you know, he really just worked in order to live. And, you know, he lived in Europe and although he was single, he kept a 3-bedroom apartment just so people could come and visit him. And he was just a lovely man. And, you know, it was very poignant, I mean, in retrospect, having, you know, the fact that I had gone to this funeral and I had learned kind of what a celebration of life was. Like, I didn't even know that you could have a memorial service or a funeral call it a celebration of life. You know, I just thought it was going to be a morose sort of thing. And, you know, there was lovely pictures of him, you know, and all his favorite music. And that was new to me.
In terms of dealing, the tools that you use to deal with grief, would religion have been one of them? It obviously didn't work for you, but what else? I mean, having your family around, having the children around, obviously.
Yeah, religion definitely wasn't a part of it. I had a very sort of surreal experience in the church.
It's almost comical.
It is comical, yeah. And strangely, often my experiences in churches are that way. I don't know why, but in the book, strangely enough, it's a therapist. I do some massage therapy, and that is just incredibly healing. I talk with psychics, and, you know, as sort of woo-hoo-hoo they are, you know, it was really, really helpful because it was just, you know, I think I was constantly striving for that idea that he was close by. And odd things were happening, you know, and I was sort of, you know, I was willing to accept the fact that they might be him, you know, sort of lights going off in the hallway or, you know, the CD player going on and that sort of thing, you know, just sort of funny little signs. I was smelling smoke a lot of the time. Wherever I went, I'd smell smoke. And after a while, I mean, it just became so often that it just became my, you know, like I knew he was around whenever I smelled smoke. So all these little things kind of, you know, they all kind of contributed to sort of making me feel better. And I was just sort of willing to accept them as, you know, I don't know if I wanted to call it my new religion, but it kind of for me was the religion that I was lacking. You know, it's just you kind of glom on to what it is you need. And at that time, that's what it was.
Did you talk to other 9/11 widows? I just hate using that phrase, but did you talk to other young women who have lost husbands?
Yes, absolutely.
You find that helpful?
It was sort of both helpful and not all at once. You know, it was helpful in that, you know, I knew I wasn't alone, and we were kind of having the same experience, and that it was very bizarre. We all had media calling us and that kind of thing. And so we were able to sort of relate on that level. But I felt also very, very kind of removed with, how do I explain this? It was sort of, I felt very sort of different than they were. You know, like I'd sit in a room at one point and they were sort of saying, oh my goodness, I can't believe this happened on American soil. I mean, how horrible is this? And I sort of piped up and went, well, really? I mean, I'm kind of surprised it didn't happen sooner, you know, and it was just like, you know, like, you know, all the, like, it was like blasphemy, you know, it was sort of just not said. And so it was at that point that I kind of realized that maybe I had, you know, maybe my Canadian roots were tits are showing at this point, you know, because maybe I didn't quite see eye to eye, you know, like I was not surprised that this had happened, but they really seemed to be. And so there were sort of very subtle fundamental differences that started to creep in and you know, and left me feeling as though I was a bit of a fish out of water, you know, like I wasn't quite with my right school somehow, you know, and that was a bit unnerving. So after a while, I tended to not seek out the other widows as much.
The title of the subtitle of the book, I should say, is A Young Widow's Transformation. Is one always a widow?
Oh, that's a good question.
You've started dating again, correct?
Oh, a little bit. I haven't dated now for a while, but yeah. I mean, I guess to a certain degree, yeah. You kind of always are a widow. You know, you always have that experience. You know, loss sort of that's that close really does change you. And you know, I mean, I think everybody always assumes that it changes you for the worse. And I hope that what comes across in my book is the idea that it's not always for the worse, that actually sometimes it's for the better. And it's hard because you feel very guilty about that. You feel like, oh, you know, Aaron had to die for me to become a better person. But it's kind of an experience that a lot of us have, you know. And, yeah, so I think in that sense, I will always be a widow, and I will sort of wear it proudly, on, you know, on a funny way, because it's a very big part of who I am. You know, obviously I don't want to be known as, oh God, the 9/11 widow, you know, Miss Depressing, and I think that's probably a perception that a lot of people have, you know, and I'm sort of not that person at all, you know. I like to have fun, and you know, I'm through probably the hardest part of the process of grieving, but you know, which as I say before, it doesn't mean it goes away; it's still always there. But yeah, I think to a certain degree, I will always be a widow.
In terms of your instincts, the idea of one's instincts, that's obviously changed since Aaron's death for you.
Yeah.
You're more instinctive, do you think? You're more, did you do things more on a whim?
Well,
than
I think what it is just, you know, something like that, you know, this sort of big trauma, this big loss, I think it forces you to kind of reassess your life a little bit. And I think it kind of, you know, it's sort of, it takes away the fear that you might have had of death. And it's weird when, I don't know why the fear of death it holds us back, or if it's really just a fear of ourselves. You know, I realized that I was the one holding myself back from doing a lot of things. I mean, I never thought I could write a book. I never thought I was a good writer. You know, I'd had a ninth grade teacher who told me I wasn't a very good writer, and so I believed him. You know, and suddenly after all this happened, it was like, oh, who cares if I'm a bad writer? I'm just going to write it anyway. You know, like life is too short. So suddenly you take on this whole new kind of sort of way of looking at the life, at life, where you sort of go, well, life's short, so I better stop wasting it, you know, and I better just sort of take advantage of that opportunity, because I'm never going to get that opportunity again. And so, you know, when it came to big decisions like, you know, who should I invest my money with, or you know, should I move to Seattle? I found I was much more in tune with kind of my gut or my heart. And I tended to kind of disregard my head. You know, my head was saying, well, you know, it's much more logical for you to move back to Toronto. It's where your family is, and that's where you need to be. And I was going, but, you know, my heart was sort of going, but, you know, I really like Seattle. I mean, it's just as simple as that. I think it's just that Seattle kind of makes me happy right now, and I think that's where I need to be. I don't know why, and it makes no sense, but that's where I'm going to go, you know. And that's kind of what I based the whole decision on. And it really didn't make any logical sense. And I have people asking me all the time why, and I never really have a very good answer for them other than that, you know. It's just like, it just felt right. And so I tend to listen to those it felt right moments, you know, because you know when things are right.
There wasn't any thought of staying in Montclair?
No, I think at that point, you know, we'd been in the house for another 4 years after Aaron died, and for me it was just becoming very claustrophobic. You know, it was, you know, the sort of the reminders of him in the house, that were so comforting at the beginning suddenly became kind of claustrophobic. And I really had this strong urge to start fresh and start new. And so, no, that was very strong. As well, I mean, we were starting to feel, I was really feeling kind of sort of the melancholy of New York. You know, it's a very traumatized area now as a result, and there are a lot of traumatized people. And I felt it quite suffocating. And so, you know, leaving that area and going to somewhere like Seattle, I mean, Seattle just felt like this lovely, you know, there was just this lovely innocence to it that, you know, although they felt the gravitas of, you know, of the event, they were sort of not marred by it the way kind of New Yorkers tend to be at this point. So, no, for me and for our kids, it just seemed really important to sort of get out from under that. And really to start fresh, and you know, I mean, there's many people in Seattle who don't even know my story. They don't even know I'm widowed. And I've known them. I mean, I just spoke with a woman. I've known her for 2 years, and she didn't know my story. So it was, yeah, it's a different persona that I've taken on there.
You obviously can't escape references to September 11th wherever you are in the world. You see it in print, you see it on the internet, you hear it on television and radio and so on. When you hear conspiracy theorists opine as to what happened that day or how September 11th came about, how do you react?
Well, I think it's always with interest. You know, I always, I'm curious to know what what other people think. You know, I mean, I think we all kind of have opinions about what happened and how it happened, and I'm certainly no different than anybody else in that sense. Sorry, my son is here making noises.
No, that's absolutely fine.
So, you know, I think I'm, I get it, you know, but...
Does it make you angry at all?
No.
Especially when people say that America perhaps deserved this.
Oh. You know, the part that makes me angry is that, you know, George Bush started a war, you know, using my husband's death as, you know, as his excuse. And I knew the moment those buildings fell that there would be some sort of world war. There would be some sort of repercussion as a result. And that's what made me mad. It was like, you know, like, please don't use Aaron's name in order to justify, you know, something that I don't agree in. I don't know that he would have either. I think he would have had the same opinion, you know. And it just, that's what kind of makes me mad. It's really not, you know, the conspiracy theories or any of that. It's sort of this, it's the vengeance, the logic of vengeance, you know, in the George Bush world.
So because of your loss, you've become a full-time writer now. Have you sent the book to your ninth grade English teacher?
I need to. Mr. Lass, if you're out there, you're getting a copy.
What are you working on now?
Well, I've really just been promoting the book. There hasn't been time. I actually only finished editing the book kind of just at Christmas time. So it's, you know, it's been sort of a breathing hiatus. And now it's been, you know, sort of a whirlwind of promotion. So I think when I get back, you know, it'll be sort of the first time where I can sort of really breathe and think, oh, okay, let's see. And I've been sort of waiting and seeing as well, you know, would a sequel make sense? You know, how is the book going to be, how are people going to react to the book? And what do people want to know next? You know, is there more there, or should I go off in a totally different direction? I'm not sure yet.
Well, Abigail, I do thank you very much for joining us today, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It is a very useful book, and continued good luck with it. The Alchemy of Loss, A Young Widow's Transformation. Abigail Carter is its author. $32.99 from McClelland & Stewart. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.